Welcome to the Solutions for Pushing Stronger Ethics in Government conference call. My name is James. I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session. During the question and answer session, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your phone. And also note this conference is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the call over to Adav Noti. Mr. Noti, you may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Adav Noti. I'm the Senior Director of Trial Litigation at the Campaign Legal Center, and I'd like to thank everybody for joining us today to talk about solutions for pushing stronger government ethics. We at CLC believe that one of the hallmarks of a healthy democracy is public confidence in the integrity of public institutions, and that public confidence has to be earned. It has to be earned through the commitment of the people who are in the government and who work with the government to uphold public service as the public trust that it is. When public servants break the public trust, it undermines the people's faith in governmental institutions, and that is a dangerous trend in a democratic system. In today's environment, we're seeing severe challenges to ethical norms, which are exposing how truly vulnerable our systems are at all levels of government. So during today's call, we're going to hear from Campaign Legal Center's Walter Schaub, Meredith McGehee, and Tara Malloy about how federal, state, and local governments can earn and keep the public's trust and maintain a healthy democracy by ensuring that public officials are subject to clear ethics laws and guidelines that help them navigate potential conflicts and hold them accountable when they break the public trust. Walter is going to talk about ethics in the federal executive branch. Meredith is going to cover legislative branch ethics, and Tara will talk about ethics at the state and local level. So our first speaker will be Walter Schaub, CLC's Senior Director of Ethics and former Director of the United States Office of Government Ethics, which we affectionately refer to as OGE. He was appointed that position in January 2013. Prior to his appointment, Walter was Deputy General Counsel and a Supervisory Attorney at OGE. He was in private practice, and he worked as a staff attorney at several federal agencies. Walter will discuss some of the current ethics challenges in the federal executive branch. And I'll just note before Walter starts that the materials that we discussed during today's call will be on our website, campaignlegalcenter.org, and will be emailed to call participants within a couple days after the call. So thank you, everybody, and thank you, Walter, for joining the call today.
Thanks, Adav. So as Adav mentioned, we've got a multifaceted ethics program over here. I'm now the Senior Director for Ethics here at the Campaign Legal Center, and the focus right now for me is the executive branch in the federal government, which is really in a state of crisis from the ethics perspective. You know, the roots of that ethics program go back a long way, actually all the way to the beginning of the Republic. But the seminal turning point for our current ethics program in its modern form was Watergate, when President Nixon's actions had left the American people wondering if there was anything they could ever trust about government again. And desperate to restore some faith in government among the public, Congress passed the Ethics in Government Act in the late 1970s. For 40 years after that, although not legally required, every president understood the need to set a strong message that conflicts of interest were something to be avoided. And so they divested their financial interests, sold them off, or put them in qualified, blind, or diversified trusts certified by the Office of Government Ethics. And now, as pretty much the entire world knows, this president broke with that tradition and decided to stay mired in conflicts of interest. The vast network of assets he's kept have really created a cloud of concern about conflicts of interest. We've got, for instance, the story this past week of China investing $500 million in a project in Indonesia that will benefit his financial interests just shortly before he immediately sent out a very strange tweet announcing new support for a Chinese telecom company that had been under sanctions, and the idea that he would direct our Department of Commerce to use American tax dollars to promote businesses and, you know, employment in China. He's praised autocratic abuses in China, the Philippines, and Turkey. These are leaders that America's presidents would normally criticize, but President Trump has Trump-branded properties in those countries. There's the curious story of the blockade out of Qatar, an important American strategic ally until recently. And there's reporting that the Kushner family, although they deny it, may have been there looking for loans and been turned down just before that. Or the decision to renew an effort at offshore drilling, and then Secretary Zinke of the Department of Interior announces an exception for the state where President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort happens to sit. Now, the problem with conflicts of interest is that we can never have enough information. We don't know what one government official says to another behind closed doors, and our president has gone to great lengths to actually create a wall of secrecy. You know, when asked yesterday about this surprising connection between the Chinese-Indonesia investment and Trump's sudden support for a Chinese telecom company, White House spokesman Rod Shah basically told reporters that it's none of America's business, that this is a privately owned company and that the American government won't comment on it. Never mind that it's a privately owned company owned by the president, and there's an appearance, at least, of a link to a governmental decision. But that's created a very significant problem at the top in terms of the ethical tone. And we've already seen the trickle-down effect it's had. The news of scandals of this administration are coming at us like out of a fire hose. You've got Scott Pruitt now under 11 investigations. Kellyanne Conway found guilty of 3 ethics violations by 2 different agencies. Ben Carson's fancy dining room table and Tom Price's charter planes. Now, here at the Campaign Legal Center, we're doing a number of things to try to respond to this crisis. We're the ones who filed the complaint that led to Kellyanne Conway being found guilty of 2 Hatch Act violations by the Office of Special Counsel, which is not related to Mueller. That's just the name of the agency. We also were part of the campaign of putting pressure on the administration to do something about VA Secretary David Shulkin's ethics problems. And in the case of Ryan Zinke, we filed a complaint with the Office of Special Counsel about him having helped a political party try to raise funds by selling the opportunity to take photos with the Interior Secretary. We're suing the General Services Administration for disclosure of government aircraft travel so we can see just how many of the government's cabinet officials have been flying around like Tom Price did. And just yesterday, we published an op-ed on the financial disclosure report for President Trump that's due today, in which he has to finally disclose his debt to Michael Cohen for the Stormy Daniel payment. And the reason that one's important is if what he discloses is much larger than the $130,000 we know about, it'll be reason for reporters to start asking about whether there were additional payments to other individuals or other nefarious things that may have flowed through that shell company that Michael Cohen set up. We've been working as well with members of Congress to help them in their efforts to conduct oversight of the executive branch and have helped them edit draft legislation. Last fall, though, we actually got a chance to have a bipartisan meeting with Trey Gowdy and Elijah Cummings of the Oversight Committee that oversees the Office of Government Ethics and got a chance to present to them 13 proposals for legislative reform. Those proposals are on our website, and there's a link in the materials we're giving you, as well as a summary of a few of the items in that. One of them, for instance, focuses on creating new investigative authority because, as everyone found out last year the hard way, the Office of Government Ethics has no real enforcement power. Another one, and I'll briefly give you some insight into this one, takes a stab at restoring the ethical norm of presidents divesting their conflicting financial interests. Now, there's a number of legal proposals that go out there that are out there right now, and I can't go into detail on the problems with them, but there are some potential problems with the various ways people have been trying to tackle that issue directly in terms of banning a president from participating in things in which he has a conflicting financial interest. This one takes a roundabout approach of trying to restore the norm by requiring presidential candidates to disclose what their plan for ethics is. And it requires specificity, the idea being that they would have to specifically identify any assets they're going to divest and specifically say how they'll mitigate any conflicts for assets they don't divest. There wasn't a lot of discussion about these kinds of things in the lead up to the election in 2016. And I think that by having them disclose these plans, it would at least force the public and the media to make this part of the discussion as people are weighing the different candidates. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that anybody's going to change political parties over conflict of interest concerns. So I think the past year and a half have shown us the opposite, that that won't happen. But the idea is that these ethics plans would be due before the first party primary, ideally even when they first file their financial disclosure report 30 days after they announce that they're running. And what that would do is enable that to be actually vigorously debated at a time when voters can afford to care about conflicts of interest without having to abandon their party. Imagine, for instance, if Donald Trump had shown up at the first primary and said, I'm not going to divest anything, and in fact, I and my staff are going to frequent my properties. I'll spend a third of my time there and about a quarter of my time on my golf course, and I'll actively promote my properties, and I will announce support for a Chinese telecom company that's under sanctions shortly after they invest $500 million in a project that will benefit me personally. I think that would have gone really badly. You can imagine Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush pouncing on him during those debates. And ideally, he would come back to the next debate with a better plan. Because another key feature, aside from the early timing of this plan, is that it can be modified at any time up to the election. So the idea is that hopefully they would engage in a bidding war for the votes by each coming back with a better plan, particularly if a debate went poorly. Or if they refused to do that, maybe the voters would pick a different candidate to be their party's nominee, but they could do that without having to abandon party. I'm not optimistic that that'll get passed before the next presidential election, although I think it would be great if it did. But I think that the public, the media, and good government groups can have a role in demanding that presidential candidates in this next election do just that. People can pose those questions. Why won't you tell us what you're going to do about your conflicts of interest? And I think if we really make it a priority to force that to be part of the discussion, and we're certainly going to be doing that here, I think it gives us a chance that maybe that ethical norm can be restored. And as we've seen in this past year and a half, tone from the top is everything. So maybe if the parties each pick a candidate who cares about government ethics, then maybe that'll work. And maybe it'll inspire this president to change his mind. I'd be perfectly happy if that happened. I don't know that I'm optimistic that it will. Anyway, so that's where we are in the executive branch, federal program, and we've got a couple other programs to talk to you about.
That's great. Thanks, Walter. And I'll remind callers that we'll have an opportunity to pose questions to all of today's speakers after all three have given initial presentations. So next we'd like to welcome Meredith McGeehy. Meredith is CLC's strategic advisor and an expert on government ethics. She's been named 10 times, including in 2017, by The Hill as one of the top nonprofit grassroots lobbyists in Washington. She speaks at universities and organizations around the country, testifies before Congress, and is frequently quoted in national news publications. She's also, in addition to all of that, she's also the executive director of Issue One, a nonpartisan nonprofit that we at CLC often partner with. Before she joined CLC, Meredith was president of the Alliance for Better Campaigns and senior vice president and chief lobbyist for Common Cause, and she worked on Capitol Hill. And during today's call, Meredith is going to talk about ethics challenges and solutions in legislative branches. Thanks, Meredith.
Thank you, Adav, and thank you for having me, and hello to those on the phone. I want to start out just briefly noting that the line between issues that fall in the kind of campaign finance or money and politics world and things that are ethics is often very blurry, very gray, and I think it's important as you think about ethics issues to conceptualize these as, if you will, arrows in the quiver of someone who wants to influence the outcome of policy decisions made by government, whether it's at the local, state, or federal level. So they have a lot of arrows in that quiver to say, how can we affect or influence the outcome of those decisions? So when you talk about ethics issues, in addition to the traditional money and politics, campaign finance, contributions, those kinds of issues, you now get into things like travel and gifts and potential conflicts of interest and enriching public officials through business dealings. So the line is blurry, but I want to recognize that some of these things are traditionally considered ethics issues. It's also important to note that often when you talk about ethics issues, you can get pretty strong bipartisan support, whereas some of the traditional money and politics issues have a tendency these days, not always that way, to fall along partisan lines. You can also often get businesses to engage in ethics discussions because they do not like the pay-to-play aspects of politics or situations where they feel like crony capitalism is the rule. So as I want to go through here and just say, as we talk both about federal legislative ethics as well as state and local, many of the themes are very similar, and there are some differences that you have to take into account. So the first area is disclosure. And by disclosure, we mean areas where there may not be restrictions on activities, but that the public needs to have information about what is going on so that citizens can be informed voters and can make up their own minds. So these get you into areas such as lobbying disclosure information, foreign agent registration disclosure, conflicts of interest and financial disclosure, and holding restrictions. When you get into the legislative branch, it's very important to note that our founding fathers built in some conflicts to the system. They wanted farmers elected, business people elected. They wanted voices from many sectors of society. But that's a far cry from saying that they should represent those sectors and that they should have financial holdings that can be directly affected by the actions they take as elected officials or as staff that are working for the legislative branch. So it is one of the goals here as we walk through that disclosure is to try and think through what are reasonable expectations in the legislative branch for elected officials to have to disclose. We know in some instances at the federal level, the financial disclosure forms are pretty much out of date. Sometimes the categories of value for financial disclosure don't really reflect the magnitude of the conflicts of interest, which is their purpose. There's a difference between requiring disclosure of your financial holdings and releasing your tax returns. And that can lead you into a big debate about what is the most appropriate information for someone who's serving in the legislative branch to disclose to the public. There are a range of policy solutions on that that have taken effect at the federal level as well as at the state level. California has its own approach and is a very robust example of financial disclosure and conflict of interest. The Office of Government Ethics has a fairly robust program here at the federal level, but there are big gaps that we are aware of and that we've been trying to push and change for many years. Second area is where you get away from disclosure and you get to restrictions or bans. And in this area are things like revolving door restrictions. What can a former legislative official or staffer do? Who should be covered by those restrictions? How long should the restrictions be? What activities does it cover? Does it just cover lobbying? Does it cover giving strategic advice? Does it cover the entire government? Does it just cover the agency where this person worked, or the branch of Congress, or the branch of the legislature where the person worked? These are all policy decisions that can be made, but there are examples all over the country as well as in Congress of how that has been dealt with, as well as some of the weaknesses. I think it's important to recognize that the revolving door statute for the federal level is pretty weak and can be easily escaped. A lot of times people just sit out for 1 year, wait for their relationship to supposedly cool off, but within 1 year that is not really the cooling off period that is anticipated. Other places where restrictions or bans are reasonable for the legislative branch is when it comes to gifts and travel. Some of that has been handled by disclosure in the past. I think that you could look at what's going on in some legislatures, including Congress, and say the notion of relying on disclosure for travel is very ineffective. When the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act was passed to effect in Congress, there was a proposal on the table to require members of Congress and staff to pay for their travel out of public dollars because that is to whom they are beholden. That did not pass, and there was great opposition to that, and so we were unsuccessful in trying to implement that kind of ban. At the state level, there are sometimes more success about trying to put some restrictions on the travel, but usually the travel is not to as many exotic locations as you see at the federal level. There are also restrictions that can be placed on the things that that members of Congress or state legislators can vote on. Recusal policies are key elements of ensuring that you can deal with conflicts of interest. How robust those recusal policies are is largely dependent on how effective the advocates are for trying to enforce those recusal standards. The last area that I would just kind of put out there is things to think about when you talk about legislative ethics is enforcement. How these policies are enforced is an absolutely key question, because if you don't have effective enforcement, then no matter what you have on the books, it's not effective. There are many states that have ethics commissions. At the federal level, there is not an ethics commission. There is an Office of Congressional Ethics. If you have this system, which I think has probably been shown to be the best system to have an independent ethics commission, it can be very difficult to work within the legislative constraints because you have problems with whatever the Constitution says. For example, for Congress, the bodies of Congress, the respective bodies, the House and Senate, are the only ones that can determine whether or not someone is allowed to stay in Congress. So you have to make sure as you look at the state level that you look at what the restrictions are in the state constitutions. There's also a very different model at the state level versus the federal level, and that is in most states, legislators are part-time legislators as opposed to the full-time. That means that the conflicts of interest are potentially greater. It means you need to have greater flexibility in how you deal with those conflicts. It means that many times, rather than having bans on activities, that you end up with disclosure of those holdings so that the public can then make up its own mind. So these are some of the elements as you go through fixing the ethics rules and standards you have in your state that you should think about. The last point I would make here is that it's also important to think through solutions that you can deal with conflicts of interest using the rules of the legislative body itself. While if certain standards were put into law, they may run afoul of the Constitution, particularly with this court. If you place those same restrictions within the rules of the body, they are not subject to the same type of constitutional and Supreme Court scrutiny. So I'll stop there.
Great, thanks, Meredith. Our final speaker today is Tara Molloy, who's going to talk about issues in states and localities and opportunities for reform in 2018. I want to thank Tara for stepping in at the last minute here in the place of Katie Kelly, who was unable to join the call. Tara is CLC's Senior Director of Appellate Litigation and Strategy, and she litigates a wide range of campaign finance and election law cases at the state level and at the federal level, and advises CLC's state and local program, which is a program through which CLC helps state and local partners develop effective anti-corruption policies that are tailored towards the needs of each community. Prior to joining CLC, Tara focused on local campaign finance enforcement, serving as an attorney at the New York City Campaign Finance Board, where she worked to administer New York City's public financing system. Thanks, Tara.
Great. Thanks for allowing me the opportunity to discuss state and local ethics efforts, which at this point is focusing particularly on the design and enactment of ethics commissions to enforce these laws. I should also note that I have the privilege, as Adav noted, of swooping in at the last minute to take credit for the very hard work of Katie Kelly, who is our program director of the state and local program, which is spearheading, of course, CLC's efforts in this area. So first, I'll turn to why state and local reform, why focus here, particularly as Walt has pointed out, our federal government seems to be in a, quote, state of crisis. Well, one, state and local government is central to the daily life of most people in this country, sometimes even more so than federal government, despite the breathless media coverage of every development at that level. So it's important that you build confidence in our public institutions at every level of government, because then the expectation that officeholders will be held account to their behavior will hopefully follow the officeholders as they make their way up the chain of government. And this points to a second reason that state and local ethics work is so important, and that is that federal office holders often serve in state elected office before they seek federal office. It's an important training ground for our elected officials, and it sets patterns, hopefully, for ethical behavior, not unethical behavior. Finally, to sound a practical note, state and local reform is possible. If politics is the art of the possible, there's often more opportunities for reform at the state and local level. There's less partisan gridlock sometimes than at the federal level. And what's more, states often have the added possibility of enacting laws through the ballot referendum process, which takes the decision out of the hands of sometimes very reluctant officeholders and puts it into the hands of a sometimes very enthusiastic public that wishes to drain the swamp. So that's why state and local ethics reform. Let's move to how we should go about this. One of the big roles that CLC attempts to play in this arena is in the design and drafting of various reform laws. And as I noted earlier, one of the big focuses in this election cycle is the design and enactment of laws that would create ethics commissions that in turn would enforce the laws. You know, it's very nice and certainly good to have strong ethics laws and norms, but without enforcement of those laws, you have not a whole lot than some pretty words on paper. And that might explain the upsurge in public and reformer interest, again, in creating these ethics boards or ethics commissions. But the design of these is incredibly important, and of course the devil is in the details. We at CLC have just put together a document outlining the principles and best practices for creating the Ethics Commission to do this important work. We're hoping that it will be available on this website today, but I'll give you a quick overview now. So the crucial design features of ethics enforcement or the creation of Ethics Commission, there's at least three. One, an Ethics Commission, and this should probably be self-evident, but it should be have some degree of independence from the office holders that they should oversee. One big question there is where in government or law should the Ethics Commission be housed? And this is an incredibly important question. As we'll see, it's a reoccurring theme in lots of state and local efforts to actually create these enforcement bodies. So which branch of government should it be in? Should it be created by constitution or should it be created by statute? Other questions of independence might turn on how commissioners are appointed, how they can be removed. Finally, there is important to look at who can serve on the commission. For instance, you may not want lobbyists on your commission. You may not want governmental contractors on your commission, and there may be other restrictions to keep in mind. So second crucial design feature is that the ethics commissions have to be effective. That means they need sufficient authority to actually hold officials accountable for violations of the law. You might ask, can commissions receive or investigate complaints? Can they conduct audits? Also very key, do they have power to impose fines? Do they have subpoena power, which is really a necessary engine for any investigation? And finally, another key design aspect of the commission is to think thoroughly about what its approach to providing guidance to the regulated community will be and an education to the public. In addition to just enforcing the law, the commission should be authorized to provide advice and encourage compliance with the laws to prevent problems before they start. It's important to do this to create not just enforcement of the law, but really a culture of integrity within government. So that was the very, very quick overview of our best practices in the design of these ethics commissions. And so now that we've discussed the ideal in terms of ethics enforcement, what is the reality? And the good news here is that there's at least three states that will be or are very close to having propositions on the ballot in 2018 that would create meaningful and effective ethics enforcement. So these three states, I'll start with South Dakota. There is already a constitutional amendment qualified for the ballot to create an ethics commission, as well as to enact certain campaign finance and lobbyist regulations. I should note that South Dakota is in perhaps the unenviable position of being at their second try at this effort, sort of they're at take two. Some on the call may recall that in 2016, voters in the state actually passed Initiative 22, which created by statute at that time an ethics commission within the state, as well as other campaign finance measures, including the state's first ever ban on gifts from lobbyists. Although this is a wonderful and heroic effort, the initiated statute was almost immediately repealed by the state legislature. And this highlights the difficulty in trying to enact these types of measures through statute as opposed to a constitutional amendment, which is the tactic that is now being taken. It's also interesting, though, that there is a parallel court case that challenged Initiative 22 as well as this repeal effort. And the trial court had actually struck down the Ethics Commission for disrupting the structure and separation of powers in the states. So in an attempt to make this commission independent, they had sort of created it outside either the legislative or executive or, I suppose, even judicial branch of government. And the court said, no, there's only three branches of government. You may not create an independent ethics commission. So the very key feature of a commission, i.e. its independence, is sometimes what gets it in trouble, which, again, is why it's so important to sound this theme of how are you going to house or position this ethics commission to both be both independent and constitutional. But we are on our second take in South Dakota, and again, there is a constitutional amendment this time that would create a 7-member ethics commission. The commission would have authority over ethics rules covering elected and appointed officials, judges, and state and local government employees. They also have a specific mandate to conduct educational programs for the benefit of the public and those office holders subject to these laws. So that is one effort that we will keep track of. The second state I wanted to highlight was North Dakota, which is a little bit earlier in the process of qualifying for the ballot. There's a proposed state constitutional amendment that has not yet gotten on the ballot. Signatures will be submitted in June. This ballot measure would create a commission of 5 commissioners that would be selected by agreement of the governor and the leaders of the state Senate. They'll have the power, this commission, to investigate and adopt rules related to transparency, corruption, ethics, and lobbying. The proposition also provides that the legislature must provide adequate funding to ensure the commission can fulfill its purpose. The proposal would also have certain requirements in terms of the disclosure of political spending, as well as a ban on lobbyist gifts and revolving door protections as well. Finally, I would just highlight New Mexico. They are also taking the constitutional route, and Constitutional Amendment 2 is already on the ballot after being referred by the legislature. This would also create another ethics commission, this time 7 members, which would be appointed alternatively by the governor, the legislative majority and minority leaders there's a long process for appointments in an effort, again, to keep this independent of all the office holders that the commission is meant to oversee. The commission should have authority over state officers, executive and legislative branch employees, campaign finance, authority over lobbyists as well. And it may receive, initiate, and investigate complaints and issue advisory opinions. So sort of have a full range of powers. So these are the three states that we are watching over and have a lot of hopes for ethics in reform in the states. And I'll leave it at that.
Great. Thank you, Tara. So now as we transition to the question and answer session, I'd just ask the operator to give instructions to callers on how to submit questions.
Very good. Thank you. We can now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your phone. If you wish to be removed from the question queue, you can press the pound sign or the hash key. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, press star 1 on your phone. And I believe the first question is coming from Adav.
Yep. Yep. Thank you. Yeah. So while people submit their questions, I'll get the process started here. So we've talked about these topics today. We've talked about federal executive branch ethics and legislative branch ethics and state and local ethics, and we've presented them as three distinct issues. I guess my question would be, you know, are they in fact distinct? Are there ways in which these areas overlap with each other, or are somehow mutually reinforcing, or are they really sort of three different topics that really are best considered uniquely and distinctly? Walter?
So my thinking is that some of the themes are the same in both of them, you know, at all the different levels. What you run into is different obstacles. For instance, in the states, sometimes you have legislators who are part-timers and have outside jobs, so they come with baggage of conflicts of interest right from the start. But the principles and the ideas the same. I mean, ultimately, it's about ensuring that entrusted power is not abused. That is the very definition of corruption. And I think in every case, the goal is the same, just the obstacles and how to get there are different. And I think one other way they overlap is that a lot of times elected officials in our federal government, whether you're talking a president or legislators, or even some high-level cabinet officials, come from state government. And we see a culture clash sometimes even when people move from the legislative branch, where things are quite a bit looser, to the executive branch in the federal government. The culture clash is all the greater coming from state to federal. But if you build an expectation at the state level of government ethics, that carries with them as they come into the federal government. And these days, the crisis in the federal government is so bad, it may be the states that are going to have to lead in restoring ethics, because the federal government has shown no interest in doing that. We don't even have a Congress willing to conduct meaningful oversight.
This is Meredith. I would just add one thing that I think as you go forward and thinking about ethics, there are many reporters particularly who I think when you talk about ethics roll their eyes a little bit that, oh, you're just expecting people to, you know, be perfect human beings. Or there are politicians that look at these efforts and say, oh, you're just being too strict. There's two points that are really key to thinking through ethics. One is that politicians are, in fact, just like the rest of us. That's why we need to have good ethics rules, because things that you would do in your normal private life, which are perfectly appropriate, have a totally different impact if you are serving as a public official. So this is saying that we need strong ethics laws is not saying that politicians are worse or inherently evil. It is saying that they have different positions, different power, and therefore different responsibilities. The next part is a more philosophical part, which is we know that the public confidence in our system is at an all-time low. We know that Russia and other foreign actors have been spending a lot of time trying to reduce public confidence in democracy, not only here in the United States, but in Western Europe. And I know many people in America get very turned off when you start talking about the conflict or about ethics. It's always important to remember that democracy is the way that a civilized country resolves conflict. Conflict is at the heart of democracy. The other alternative is usually war. So what we're trying to do here is make sure that our democracy has the competence of the governed, and that the controls that are put in place are recognizing that with power doesn't come greater responsibility.
Yeah, and this is Tara. I would just agree and reinforce Walt's point that, of course, in many respects, the same principles govern both state, local, and federal ethics, even though there are going to be specific facts that require you to tailor the laws to the different situations. But I think just on a much more practical level, oftentimes they are addressing the same sort of players, political players. So if you have a law that increases transparency at the state level in terms of political spending, you can often learn about who the donors are to groups that might be active in other states or at the federal level. Or sometimes state laws may affect federal office holders. There's an effort, for instance, to require through state law presidential candidates to disclose their tax returns. So there's not this absolute wall between state and local efforts, not just in terms of the principles, but actually just in terms of practically the people and entities being affected.
Great. Thank you all. Do we have questions from callers?
Yes, we do. Our first question is from Patience Burke.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, awesome. Hi. My name is Patience Burke. I am the director of a small nonprofit called Pundico. We use political satire to try and educate and motivate people. I wanted to point quickly to the Downs model. It's probably the only political theory I know well enough to talk about off the cuff, and it basically exists as a climatic structure. You know, at the start of things, you have a public that's largely unaware about a major issue, and then you have a quick climatic climb where you have some sort of catastrophe that opens up a window of opportunity. And once that window closes, the interest wanes, and you're stuck with whatever kind of legislative or administrative infrastructure you get into place during that window of opportunity that, again, is opened by whatever the crisis or catastrophe is. And this really, I think, aligns with where we are now. I feel like we're probably getting closer and closer to that catastrophe. It feels kind of like a slow-moving catastrophe, a little bit like the Austin Powers bit with the steamroller where the security guards are coming slowly at him. So maybe we have a little bit of time to prepare, but it makes me really curious and eager to know, excuse me, to know a little more specifically about where we might be at. We heard some about the state level ballot measures, but where we might be at the federal level as far as getting some sort of bipartisan coalition of people that would be willing to really push forward with some sort of meaningful legislation that is going to address these ethical concerns. You've mentioned that you have these different proposals that you've been working with members of Congress
yep.
with. I'm curious to
sure.
know.
Sure, yeah. So Walter,
really
Walter,
are.
Yep. Thank you. Walter has some thoughts on that.
So I think one of the disappointing things has been the breakdown of the checks and balances that we all learned about in high school civics, that when you have one team in charge of everything, there seems to be a reluctance to conduct the meaningful oversight. Ultimately, I think the short answer to your question is the pressure on members of Congress to hold the president accountable is going to have to come from the people, because I don't think they're going to care unless they fear that it'll affect their reelection chances. And the only thing I know along those lines, and it sounds similar to what your group is doing, is to just really promote awareness. And I think awareness and drawing attention to issues in general just really is probably the most powerful weapon we have, as you know, and that's why the First Amendment is so important.
Great. Thank you. We have our next question, please.
Our next question is from William Schlutler. And before I open William's line, we just want to remind people we have quite a queue here of questions. So try to keep the question brief so everyone gets a chance to ask their question. And also, please, no follow-ups. Thank you. William, please go ahead.
Thank you. This is Bill Schlutler, former state senator of New Jersey. I've written a book called Soft Corruption. It deals with ethical misbehavior, which is harmful to the public interest, but the activities are perfectly legal. And the recommendation that I make for correcting this was actually approved by Craig Holman, I think, of the your center when he was with the Brennan Center in New York back in 2001. And that is that states, and this is more at a state level than a federal level, that states have an initiative and referendum on a limited number of ethical issues, such as campaign finance, conflict of interest, lobbying, patronage, and so on. And the state people will do the correcting because the politicians, they won't. They will find ways to circumvent it and to get around it.
Sir, do we have a question for the panelist?
Well, the question is, how about giving the power, this power to the people through initiative and referendum?
Well, yeah, so this is Tara. Well, I think you and CLC are in heated agreement here. We absolutely see this as one of the main ways forward to sort of springboard off our last question. You know, although there are definitely a lot of attempts being made to move things at the federal level, there are actively, you know, measures on the ballot now in many, many states that concern the ethics process, that concern campaign finance, that creating public financing. And you're absolutely right that it's often the people that are much more supportive of these efforts than the politicians, who, whatever they may feel, are often beneficiaries of the status quo. So I think that absolutely that's going to be the path forward, at least in the short term, even while we create the foundation for long-term federal and broader reform.
Right, and of course there are no federal ballot measures, so there's no limit to how that can be used at that level. The next question, please.
Next question is from Ken Doyle, Bloomberg Government.
Hello there. I just wanted to see if you could quickly go over again what you expect to see in this Trump financial disclosure report in terms of the debts that you're saying ought to be disclosed, and whether you think you're really going to see that.
Sure. Good question. What he's required to disclose is any liability of any sort that exceeded $10,000 at any time in calendar year 2017.
Mm-hmm.
OGE has issued opinions clarifying that they read the definition of liability as broadly as possible. Basically, if you're on the hook for it, you have to disclose it. It should have been disclosed last year. I think the defense he's tried to raise is lack of knowledge. That seems pretty implausible, though right now we lack the evidence to be able to prove otherwise. But it's undoubtable that he has the information now. And what's disclosable is his debt to Cohen or to anybody else who's made payments on his behalf, not the payments themselves. And so what he has to disclose is a personal debt to Michael Cohen, and he has to check the value category. If that value category proves to be much higher than $130,000, I think reporters should really press hard for an explanation as to what does the balance of that go toward. And if we see, and the problem for him is if he discloses this debt to Michael Cohen, that means if he owes anybody else any other money, he's now on notice that this is legally required and that this is something he should be asking himself whether he has others. And so for the risk that Mueller or someone else might discover that he had undisclosed loans, he's in a very tough spot right now. Now, do I think he'll disclose it? I think it comes down to whether the acting director of the Office of Government Ethics, Dave Apol, is willing to uphold the law and enforce it, or if he's going to create new exceptions that have never existed. I would have had more confidence in Apol prior to his signing off on the Patriot Legal Expense Fund, which is the worst thing I've ever seen come out of the Office of Government Ethics, because it creates the potential for putting pressure on witnesses not to testify adversely to the president. So am I optimistic? I don't know what to expect. I know that in any past year, the career staff at OGE would have insisted on it being reported, but APOL's got kind of a bad track record, so we'll have to hold our breath and see.
Thanks, and thanks for the question,
Ken.
Our next question from Alan Smith, Business Insider.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for doing this. You're going to be very mad at me, but I'm going to do two questions. I promise I'll get them out really quickly. The first one, I know, Walter, earlier in the call, you were talking about how you guys had all these recommendations for how to strengthen the Office of Government Ethics. I think with ethics, the FEC and the OGE kind of go hand in hand a little bit, especially at the federal level. And I'm curious if these two entities never really had the proper tools to really deal with enforcement, or if you think that over time these two agencies have been disintegrated to the point where, you know, they don't have the proper ability. And if you think they've been disintegrated, who was really the root cause for that? The other question, really simple, what do you think is the biggest thing to come out of these revelations about the payments companies made to Michael Cohen? What's the biggest thing to look for with these going forward?
Right, well, let's start with the first part about OGE and the FTC.
So, in answer to your question, Alan, it depends on what we hoped that the Office of Government Ethics would do. I have to say, it wasn't a perfect agency, and it had its flaws. We made our mistakes, but we had a very effective prevention mechanism in the Office of Government Ethics for about 40 years. And I don't think it changed gradually. I think it came to a crashing halt when the president took power. We saw something similar with the Department of Justice reversing its longstanding position on nepotism. That's a half-century-old statute, and DOJ had four times told presidents in written opinions that they couldn't hire relatives into the White House, and they reversed that opinion minutes after the inauguration in 2017. So I think in the case of the Office of Government Ethics and some parts of DOJ, it was an abrupt halt. If I have to guess, I think Tara's going to tell you that the FEC had a gradual decline. But.
Well, I'm going to actually answer all of the above to your question. That is that there were both systematic design flaws to the FEC, as well as sort of a gradual erosion of its enforcement efforts. One of the key design flaws is that, of course, they are an even-numbered commission divided between the parties. No more than three can be from the same party. And this means that you need four votes to do anything, and this means you get four votes basically never on any important enforcement action or other action. So there is something baked into the system. However, I think many would say that a great deal of the problem is the actual appointees to the commission, and that some of the appointees have taken an increasingly deregulatory tone and hostile tone to the campaign finance laws they're meant to implement. So there are design problems, but there are also just problems in terms of who's been appointed and how they've gone about their business. But yes, I think that your overall thrust of your question, that both of the watchdogs here seem to be in crisis, is correct.
And I'll just add, this is Meredith. We've often talked about the FEC as the most successful agency in Washington because it does exactly what it was designed to do, which is nothing.
I almost stole that joke, Meredith.
Yeah,
I
just want to put a pin in one thing about the Office of Government Ethics because it's an agency I've been watching since the 1980s. There was a hearing that was held by Senator Chuck Percy in the 1980s on the Office of Government Ethics. And one of the recommendations that came out of that hearing was that the director of the Office of Government Ethics should only be removed for cause.
I remember that.
And so there are some built-in problems with the agency. There was disagreement about the extent of its ability to enforce. We know that the Federal Election Commission was hampered explicitly by a Democrat, Mr. Hayes. The original idea was an odd-number commission that came from a Republican in the Senate, Senate Minority Leader Scott. So these agencies are, to some degree, the victims of exactly what folks in Washington wanted them to be.
And Don McGahn didn't do either program any favors. The second question you had asked was about the Cohen payments. You know, I think we've yet to find out the full scope of what the Cohen payments were or what they mean, and it's just hard to know the significance. I think it's a really big deal. I think that in particular, the extent to which he appeared to be trying to sell access to government was not like anything I've seen before. It's certainly not business as usual. In Washington, anybody who's cynical enough to say that is either exaggerating or has a motive, because in reality, this is different in degree and maybe in nature significantly. It's not clear the extent to which the president was endorsing or sanctioning his behaviors, and so that's a missing piece in the puzzle. And it's not clear what all of the money was for or where all of it came from. So I think there's a lot more to be revealed. And I think it's a really important piece of the concerns about corruption in this administration right now.
Great. Thanks. We could take another question.
Our next question from Kate Ackley, CQ Roll Call.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it. I wanted to know the forms that are due today, whether they're the president's or someone else's, when might we be able to see those publicly? And do any of you have a sense of what's going on with the nomination of Emory Rounds to be director of OGE?
So I'll answer the second one first because I can be more concrete in that. I have been contacted by both the minority and the majority asking about Emory Rounds. In the case of this upcoming hearing, it seemed like they were doing essentially a reference check because I had been his boss. And I gave him a glowing review in both cases and encouraged them to confirm him. I think he's a very good choice for this job. Unfortunately, to my knowledge, they haven't scheduled a hearing yet. And when I was talking to some of them in March, they had predicted the hearing would occur in April. So I don't know why it's moving slowly. It seems like it should be a pretty non-controversial career-level hiring, and certainly as one of the administration's critics on ethics, I've been very complimentary of them. So I think they're not expecting significant opposition unless any of his answers are unsatisfactory. On the other, what was the question again about that?
When we'll
see it. So in the past, and I've managed to locate the financial disclosure forms online, every one that President George W. Bush and President Obama filed, and every last one was filed on or before the May 15th deadline. And my understanding while I had been at OGE is that everyone prior to that had been as well, although I haven't been able to find the documents out here in the public to confirm that. But the tradition was OGE works with the agency, with the president's attorneys in advance on drafts to help them get it perfect so that it can be filed and then released the same day. Last year, we released it two days later because they submitted it at 5 o'clock on a Friday, and we had to do a line-by-line comparison of that very long report to make sure that nothing had changed since the draft that we had green-lighted. So in theory, if he files today, you should see it by Thursday. My understanding, though, is OGE has been giving some very strange answers to reporters calling about where things stand, and I'd encourage you to call them and see what they'll say. But, you know, technically they have 30 days by law to release it, but if they cite that, it's a half-truth because the reality is that the tradition has been release it the same day or as shortly thereafter as you can double-check its contents.
And we could probably squeeze in one more quick question.
And that would be Dan Fort.
Oh, Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Walt, how are you doing?
Dan's a career ethics official who recently left.
After many, many years. Well, and my question sort of concerns that. And I was wondering if you would speak to the future role of career executive branch ethics officials in carrying out your proposed reforms. And what about the role of the IG versus career ethics officials? Basically, who's going to do the work?
One of the obstacles the IGs are facing is that IG positions are being left open. That was the case in the last administration, and it's even more the case in this administration. So that an acting person can do good work, but ultimately they're a babysitter and they can't really initiate significant reforms or make really difficult, controversial decisions if they can help it. And the career ethics officials, unfortunately, the trend is increasingly to cut their budgets and ask them to do more with less. There's an official at OMB, I forget her name, but you can Google it, who notoriously said, everybody says do more with less. I say just do less. And unfortunately, that's and she was talking to IGs at the time. I think that's where things stand. Now, the one thing I can say is I have a great deal of faith in the career ethics officials like Dan here on the phone. And what's difficult for them, though, is they work for the political appointees who they're having to steer towards ethical behavior. And so they're limited in what they can do. And that's where it really falls on the shoulders of the Office of Government Ethics to be the bad guy and support them by being willing to provide them cover. I'm hopeful that Emory Rounds can be that if he gets confirmed. And then the answer to your question is Emory will do the work, along with all of the hardworking agency ethics officials.
One of the issues that's raised about the way the OGE operates for, again, it's built into the statute, I just want to note, is the difference between how career ethics folks, career federal officials are governed under the statutes versus the political appointees, and especially the upper level political officials, cabinet officials. If you're someone who is a rank and file or a high level, you have one set of standards that you really are applied pretty strenuously. If you're someone who's a cabinet level official, those same standards somehow can often be ignored. And so you have this tension between how you deal with the very top level of government and all the rest of the federal executive branch officials, how they work and the rules they live under. So that's a built-in tension into the system that is worth noting.
We saw that with Kellyanne Conway having been found guilty of 3 ethics violations by 2 different federal agencies, one of which was led by a Trump appointee, and nothing happened to her. I think it's not a matter of law, it's a matter of practice, but unfortunately it does seem to be the practice.
Well, that's fantastic. I want to thank all of our speakers and participants on the call for joining us today. For additional information and for the documents that have been discussed, they'll be on our website, campaignlegalcenter.org, within the next couple days, and they'll be emailed to everybody who RSVP'd for the call. If you want more information or to contact us, you can email info@campaignlegalcenter.org. Members of the media should use the address media@campaignlegalcenter.org. So thank you all very much again, and have an excellent afternoon.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.